Mr. Sherwood, reel four.
Not having had to shoot this sentry, and time having run out, we decided, discretion being the better part of valour, with about 15 or 20 minutes left to get back to the boats, to make our way back to the boats. And a great deal of time had passed as we sort of made our way up the cliffs, up through the sand hills, and crouched under the lee of the top of the bluff and so forth. So we made our way, the two of us made our way back down to where we'd left the canoe and the raft. And as we went down, a figure appeared out of the shadows, running hell for leather uphill, not seeing us at all, running back up to the top of the bluff. Never discovered who he was. But he didn't take any action. Perhaps he didn't see us. But we carried on our way and got back down to where we'd left the boats to find all except two, the rest of the boats, already there. They hadn't achieved anything either. The two who weren't there and who didn't come back, they had been successful. They'd planted some of these plastic bombs and some lorries, which in due course had gone off. But they'd got themselves captured as well, which was potentially very nasty for them, because by that time Hitler's order, or edict, that any commandos caught should be shot there and then had already come out. We didn't know anything about that then, by the way. Might have cramped our style a bit, I suppose, if anybody told us. But these two went into the bag, and one of them was a Lieutenant Michael Alexander, who was some sort of relative of Field Marshal Alexander, and who later, as a prisoner, was considered important enough to be incarcerated at Colditz. He survived the war, as did the chap with him. They weren't shot, and I suppose they were very lucky. Anyhow, we were assembled back on the beach, only to find the blow-up life raft had a puncture all the time. It was flying as flat as a pancake in the water, covered with sand and seawater. Fortunately, it had a pump. And I remember getting hold of this pump, since nobody else seemed to know what to do about it or something like that. And finding that when I started, it was a hand pump, sort of squeeze, bellows-like thing. And I found when I worked this, it made a ghastly sort of squeaking, metallic squeaking noise. So having got away with it so far, we felt absolutely certain by now that somebody would hear this noise and come and investigate. But nobody came, and we got away with it. And we got this wretched thing blown up and launched with ourselves in it, leaving behind the canoe, turned upside down, with sand roughly scuffled over it, in case the other two chaps should get back later and be able to get out away themselves and then paddle up the coast, round the front line and back to the British lines. Not an impossible thing to do, done with care and by night. But of course they didn't come back, as we learned later. By now we were afloat on the dark sea again, periodically having to operate this squeaky pump and keep the raft from deflating again, whilst looking in vain for the motor torpedo boat. We didn't have any binoculars, so we were reliant on spotting its silhouette by crouching low in the raft and seeing it against the starlit sky. And as you probably know, even if there's no moon, a clear starry sky, an incredible amount of brightness. You can see a tremendous amount once your eyes are accustomed to it. And we'd reached a stage where we were figuring, if we can't see the MTB, what do we all do in this almost unmanageable raft? There were ghastly things to paddle. They had short wooden paddles. We seemed to spend most of our time sort of slowly gyrating and slowly progressing ourselves in a sort of series of whirls out to sea. And we determined that if worse came to worse, we'd just have to paddle on by night, land eastwards, land further along the coast, lie up by day, hope to get away with it, pump the raft up again, and hope eventually get back to our own side. But this was that's about all we can do. There was no planning involved. We had to have some sort of contingency. And as we must have been getting on to about 1 or 2 in the morning by now, close to the rendezvous time with the MTB, when we heard it, she hadn't spotted us. She started up her engines, and immediately we pinpointed where she was. We were surprised that hearing the engine start up, the more Veery lights and gunfire fired in the start up after it too, his engines again, but nothing again happened. What the Germans were doing that night, I've no idea. It's extraordinary. I suppose it shows you what you could really get away with if you set your mind to it. So we got alongside the MTB, and they hauled the raft up, we got up on board, and the skipper said he'd hang around till about first light, but he couldn't afford to stay any longer, and would then have to run back to Alexandria in daylight, in the hopes that these two chaps would turn up. He stayed as long as he possibly could, and we all stayed up on deck, keeping our eyes open and so forth, see if we could spot them, but they didn't come back. As I've indicated already, they went into the bag. And we got back to Alexandria. So it didn't really achieve anything, except that we felt at least we were trying to do some operations. But no great result came from that. One or two lorries were blown up.
When approximately would it have been? Spring of 42?
This was 42. When did Alamein open up?
That was about October 42.
That's right, it was, wasn't it? That's right. Yes. I suppose this would have been about June, May, June of 42?
Yes.
Yes. Yes, as near as I could place it. And we got back to Alexandria, and we were hailed in before various officers to give an account of ourselves and tell them what had happened and how these chaps, including Michael Alexander, had failed to return. And that was the end of that. I can't now remember what happened to us. There was a period when we were the SBS then was in a sort of limbo. And at one period, and it must have been well before that, because the Navy had disappeared from Alexandria, we'd found ourselves temporarily billeted on the battleship Queen Elizabeth, by then in dry dock in Alexandria, having been sat on the bottom by those Italian frogmen, who very valiantly stuck their limpet mines very successfully on the bottom of the ship and sank her. And that was a period when our continued existence was somewhat touch and go. But we did no operations for quite a long period. And finally, all found ourselves, and I don't know when finally was, but it was sometime obviously in 42, after these abortive so-called raids along the coast, we all found ourselves back at Cabrit, the naval station, on the Great Bitter Lake. Before this, the SAS had come into operation under David Stirling. And David Stirling had very much more pull because he was fairly high family connections with the powers that be in Cairo, even though then he was only a lieutenant. He was Scots Guard lieutenant, so he had the right contacts. Roger Courtney didn't. He wasn't in the same league. The SAS was established down at Cabrit, and we soon learned that they aspired to take over the SBS, requiring all of us to do a parachute course before joining them. We didn't want to join the SAS. We did not have anything to do with them. We wanted to remain our own independent force. However, in the end, their greater strength prevailed, and we were absorbed into the SAS, while still known as the SBS. And we were all told, right, you'll all be doing a parachute jump. But I think by that time I was a corporal or a sergeant. I had promotion over the period. And another chap and I were determined that we're not going to be sort of bludgeoned into parachute jumping or SAS or anything else we could get away with. So we asked for an interview with the CO at that time. I should have mentioned earlier that Roger Courtney had by then returned to England to start up a number 2 SBS. So we had a new CO, a man named Michael Keeley of the Devon Regiment, K-E-A-L-Y. The two of us asked for an interview with Mike Keeley, Major Keeley, and said in fairly blunt terms that we were not going to do a parachute jump and we will return to our units if necessary. He didn't call our bluff, luckily, and we stayed where we were, the only two blokes not to do a parachute jump, where all the rest did. There was no particular kudos in that. We felt we'd made a stand for the poor old SBS and stuck by it. In a regular unit, you'd never have got away with that sort of insubordination, really, of course. And later we were to do a parachute jump back in England at Roger Courtney's behest anyway. But that was another story, and much later. Round about August, I suppose, of 1942, we were told that an operation was being mounted by the SBS, by the SAS, in which the SBS would take part, which involved a vast drive southwards from the Nile Valley as far as Assiut, when we would strike westwards across the desert, south of the Great Sand Sea, for the oasis of Kufra in Libya, located, I think, about 500 or 600 miles south of the coast, for an attack on Benghazi, to try to divert the attention of the Germans and the Italians in the face of Alamein, which was about to break soon after that. It was October 42, Alamein, was it?
Yes.
Something like that. This operation was planned for September, so it made sense. And on the same night, there was to be a similar assault on Tobruk, which was an absolute disaster when it took place, but we weren't involved in that. And that's another story of which I've got no details, except a friend of mine was involved in it. In due course, the convoy, and I can't remember how many lorries and jeeps were involved, and a couple of tanks. I know it was considered to be the largest convoy to attempt to cross the desert ever. It was an enormous convoy of 3-ton, I think they were Ford trucks, open Ford trucks, without canopies, without windscreen, just open to the elements. There were hardship in that, just the hot sun of Egypt and the desert. And the SAS pushed on ahead in their convoy, and the SBS, with, I think we had 3 lorries and 2 jeeps, and were told that we have the 2 tanks to keep us company. Well, it was a hell of a journey for 2 tanks. I suppose it was possible. I suppose the total journey to Kufra, let alone getting up to Benghazi, must have been the best part of 500 or 600 miles, if not more, and most of it across the desert. We set off. There were no maps. The SAS hadn't given us any. And the only instruction we had was to leave the Nile Valley at Assiut, strike the desert track for the oasis of Kaga, which lay over to the west of the Assiut, where there's one of the high dams of Nile irrigation system, and take a bearing of, I don't know what it would have been, so many degrees, a westerly bearing, and follow that for so many miles, which were some hundreds of miles, until we struck the Wadi Halfa Kufra track. Well, tracks to us, we'd had very little experience of the desert as such. Most of our work had been on the sea and against coast. When somebody said track, we imagined, you know, the sort of rough road tracks you get in the remoter parts of this country even now, untarmac tracks, dirt tracks. Of course, it was nothing of the kind. It was just open desert. There was no, we had no mishap, but a great deal of excitement and fun trying to get through all this sand.
So and how were you supposed to...
tanks along.
How were you supposed to recognise it?
We were told that when we reached the Kufra Wadi Halfa track, we would turn right, and we'd recognise it by virtue of the enormous number of vehicle tracks in the sand. And the bearing we were following, we were told, would lead us along a track as well. But when we got onto the track, as it was called, the track could be anything up to miles wide, according to how the vehicles had used it. And if you were the first on a track to follow a bearing for, say, 400 miles that way, you were the first on that sand, so you probably made it very well. Or maybe you stuck a few times. The next vehicle following wasn't going to follow those tracks and get stuck. It would go out to left or right. And depending on over a period, the amount of traffic using that track could be anything up to 1 or 2 miles wide, according to how vehicles had been forced out to find firmer and firmer sand to drive through. And we just followed this jumble of tracks, of interweaving vehicle tracks of different kinds. And for 2 or 3 or 4 days, maybe more, I can't remember now, until we struck another great conglomeration of tracks, yards and yards across. We never did see how far across it was to the other side, coming in from our left, which was rightly assumed, but with no great certainty, that this must be the Wadi Halfa Kufra track. Wadi Halfa was away down in the Sudan, on the edge of the Sudan, way to the south, way up the Nile, and turned right. But all ideas of tracks, you know, being sort of recognizable roads with edges to them had long since vanished, and we were beginning to learn a little bit more about it. And in due course we got to Kufra. I suppose we couldn't have got lost anyhow, and I suppose if we had, somebody from the SAS would have said, isn't the SBS supposed to be with us? Haven't they turned up yet? Perhaps we'd better send somebody back and try and find them. It wasn't necessary. We got in perfectly okay with a lot of problems sticking in the sand and so forth. And believe it or not, with the wide expanse of the desert for hundreds of miles in any direction you cared to name, two tanks collided with one another. The result of that was that the tracks of one were ripped off by the other one. So these two damn great lumps of metal, one of them was immobilized in the middle of nowhere, whilst the other one was mobile. And it was decided, we'd had advice from David Sterling's staff that at a certain point and on a certain bearing, there was a huge dump of material laid in the desert some time before by LRDG or somebody like that, consisting of food, of petrol, all that sort of thing. As I remember it now, the tanks were told they'd have to look after themselves, repair themselves as best they could, get petrol from that dump, you know, 5, 15, 20 miles down that bearing, and follow us to Kufra. And they did. They turned up. They got to Kufra in the end. When the time came to leave Kufra to head north for the operation itself against Benghazi, the tanks trundled along as well, but finally gave up the ghost, maybe 40 or 50 miles north of Kufra, and for all I know, they're there to this day. They never did get to Benghazi. Total waste. Whose idea it was to send them over that vast distance? I mean, sand on, you know what it was like in the tank fighting in the desert. The sand was the biggest enemy of these things. That chewed tracks to pieces, as far as I know. We got to Kufra, caught up the rest of the SAS. We had 2 or 3 days there to sort of gather our forces and get ourselves together, get cleaned up, organized for the assault on Benghazi, lying some 500 or 600 miles to the north, and on a given day set off, heading northwards, for the Jebel Valley district, which lies slightly to the south of Benghazi. This is an area of scrub desert, wooded ravines, closer to the coast, so there's a rainfall pattern.
Did you catch up the SAS?
At Kufra, the oasis, and were with the SAS from then on. Our role, as we then discovered, since we had canoes on board, was whilst the SAS went about their part of the exercise in keeping Benghazi occupied, we were to assemble our canoes on the side of the harbour, paddle out with limpet mines, and try and sink enemy ships there. Nobody was enthusiastic about this, apart from the fact we didn't want to be with the SAS anyway. And there was a great deal of moaning and grumbling went on. Quite amusing in retrospect, but very irritating at the time. And my outstanding recollection, out of lots of minor ones, was that as we went in the night of the operation, which was, clearly remember, the 13th of September 1942, we, with our canoes, maybe half a dozen canoes, in their bags, they had to be assembled when we got to the harbour side, and a whole lot of explosive underneath canoes, with the SBS personnel, all of us, sat up on top of this lot, trundled down this trackless escarpment in the pitch dark, running late, after a raid by the RAF on Benghazi, aimed at keeping Benghazi quiet until we got into the city, the whole thing went wrong. We saw the raid from afar and watched all the fun and games and fireworks and bombs being dropped and AKAC firing at the RAF when we were still trundling down the escarpment, hopelessly late. For better or for worse, David Stirling decided the operation would carry on. We had a guide with us who was supposed to know the way, some local Arab or other. He lost the way and didn't know where he was in the end, and neither did anybody else. And we went down this escarpment with headlights full on, Stirling hoping to bluff his way with this, that anybody from afar seeing all this lot of headlights wouldn't think it was the British coming. Nobody would be stupid enough to come down with their headlights on. And so we arrived on the outskirts of Benghazi. Before that, I can clearly remember that the concern of some of the SBS personnel, and we were sort of half asleep and half dozing on the top of these canoes and explosive in this wretched three-ton lorry, was blokes grumbling at one another because one had his boots on top of another bloke. You know, get your bloody boots out of the way sort of thing. There was no concern about what was probably going to happen within the next hour or two. And when the truck stopped, one chap hopped over the side and said he was absolutely bursting and squatted down and had a crap at the side of the road whilst the truck waited and other trucks went past. It would have been laughable, really, and I think some of us did see the humour of it. But I can't remember any apprehension or concern, just the coldness of the night, everybody half asleep and thoroughly out of sorts with one another and irritable and grumbling. But that feeling was very soon dissipated because we found ourselves close up the head of the convoy, not very far behind David Stirling with his jeep, as I remember it. And we came on a proper track, a proper road, which seemed to be running on a kind of embankment, but you couldn't see terribly clearly in the dark. But ahead we could see a striped pole, you know, like those frontier poles, across the track ahead, closed. No sign of any life around it. I remember David Stirling getting out and walking up to this post. All the headlights beamed away behind him, quite casually. He was a very brave bloke, really. Just to see what was going on. And he quickly found out. Because instead of only the Italians being there, which is what everybody had expected, the whole operation had got wind of, and the Germans were there waiting for us. And given a few moments of peace and quiet, they opened up with everything they got on this convoy. They knew all about it. They knew it was us coming down with our headlights on off the escarpment. And the extraordinary thing was that they scored very few hits. And it was just as well, because sitting on top of our explosives, there'd been one wrong hit, I suppose the SBS would have disappeared in a big bang. And we were told to get out of it, every man for himself, in jeep and lorry, as best we could. So there was a great deal of confused backing and filling of trucks trying to turn round, whilst all this shot and stuff was flying all over the place, without anybody being hit, except a jeep which was hit in the petrol tank and went up in flames, which added to the already illuminated scene. And we headed out of it, having achieved nothing at all, as a complete fiasco of the whole operation.
How many casualties were there?
I don't think I ever knew. And if I gave you a number, I'd be guessing. There weren't as many as you might have expected from what was flying around. None of the SBS, none of us were hit by anything. We all ducked as though that would have made any difference. And got out of it. And at break of day, we were all herring hell for leather across this big gravelly plain, trying to get to the mountain Jebel area with its ravines and so on for concealment before the planes got up and came after us. Well, we weren't in time. They got fighters up and they were machine gunning, strafing, no bombing, from the moment it was light enough to see. And all I can remember was lorries with great clouds of dust streaming behind them, driving faster than they'd ever driven in their lives before, all trying to reach cover before the worst happened. And it just shows you, you know, you often see shots of aircraft machine gunning. Well, all this machine gunning was going on, but none of us was hit. Some of us bailed out of the truck and got away from it. We thought a plane was diving on us and ran like hell. But the plane wasn't diving on us at all. It was after another truck, which it didn't hit anyway. The driver of our truck had slowed up so we could catch up with it. So we all jumped on board again, and off again we set, streaming away for the Jebel area, and eventually gained the shelter of this with these ravines, the planes having turned back, presumably to rearm and come after us again. And one of the first sights that greeted our eyes when we got into a particular ravine with high stone walls, cliffs really, very narrow ravine, normally full of water in the rainy season, but now bone dry, was a group of blokes, SAS blokes, with a fire going and breakfast cooking, and bacon and stuff going in a frying pan, and tea and everything else, as though it was a sort of picnic. A really extraordinary sort of goings on. We didn't stop there. We thought we'd, you know, daft place to be anyhow, and we had two officers with us, and we went as far up the ravine as we could get, so we could go no further. And we had a first-rate lorry driver with us who could handle a truck if anybody could, and he got this thing up the very steep sloping sides of the ravine where it became shallower at its top end and out up onto the level ground above. And for the whole of that day we lay up. Nothing spotted us. We had camouflage netting, so that was spread all around the truck to blur its outlines. But the rest of the SAS in force, they had a fearful dusting about, I don't know, a mile or two west of us, which went on all day bombing and machine gunning. How many were lost then, I don't know. Very few, I would guess, at the first encounter at this border post, or whatever you care to call it. But I would think a lot at that, in that operation.
When the lorries were fleeing, were they zigzagging or going straight?
No, just going completely straight. Fast as they could, and straight.
What happened to you next?
We lay up all that day. We had a rough idea of where we needed to go to begin to head south again. We'd received a message from Stirling, the operation all off, head for Kufra as best you can. Again, almost each man for himself, or each lorry load for itself. Two of us had a recollection of where we were, on the map. On our way in, we'd passed a crashed aircraft, very prominently piled up at the side of one of the dirt tracks we were coming down before we started to get onto the steepest part of the escarpment on our way into Benghazi. So we volunteered to walk and see if we could find this thing. We were pretty sure we were on the right track. And by great good luck, we were. And after about an hour and a half walking, we came across this aircraft. This was no great map-reading expertise on our part, but just a sort of instinct. There was something familiar about the countryside we were looking at, and we found this aircraft. So we were able to come back and say to the officer in charge, a chap by the name of Thompson from the Royal Tank Regiment, I think, that we know where we've got to go, and at nightfall we can move and go there. Well,